I'm Warren Olney. Another split decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice John Roberts, has created a political firestorm. One provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 has been ruled unconstitutional because the court says it's based on voting patterns that have become out of date. Later on To the Point, we'll hear about the decision itself and about the impact around the country. But some parts of California also will be affected. They won't have to report to Washington whenever they make even minor changes in voting laws. Justin Levitt is professor of law at Loyola Law School. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much, Warren.
How is it that California, which certainly isn't a southern state, doesn't have a tradition that has been written about for the history of the entire history of the country, of discriminating against blacks in particular. How did California get into this?
Well, California got into this in the way that several other jurisdictions around the country got into it, based on turnout in particular counties in the late 60s and early 70s. And I'll say, while California isn't and hasn't ever been the Deep South, it has certainly had its share of contentious problems with minorities' rights, particularly minorities' voting rights. In California, largely the Asian American and Latino populations, more than the sort of typical things we saw in the Deep South with African Americans. But several counties, Kings County, Monterey County, Merced County, and Yuba County, were brought under coverage of the Voting Rights Act in the late 60s and early 70s due to extraordinarily low turnout. Less than 50% of the eligible public registering or voting in a presidential election. And that means in a country dependent on majority rule, a majority of the public wasn't even participating.
We have pretty low rates of participation now. Does that mean that if this decision hadn't happened, even more jurisdictions would have been included in the Voting Rights under the Voting Rights Act?
We do have low participation now, and certainly not anywhere near as high as I'd like, particularly in off-cycle municipal elections and the like. Presidential elections still well above 50 for the most part, and that's while it's not a sign of health, it's at least not a sign of terminal illness. The Voting Rights Act, when it brought these California counties in, based its coverage on turnout in the 1964, 1968, 1972 elections. That's the starting point. Then Congress built in a little bit of breathing room, a little bit of flexibility to both expand coverage and to contract it. So if you were good, if you were covered and you did right by your minority jurisdictions, minority voters for 10 years, then you could ask a federal court to be let out of coverage. And Merced County was the latest to do that just last year in August. If you were bad, if you intentionally discriminated against minorities, then a court could bail you in to coverage, could decide that you had to run all of your laws past it before they could be affected. And both Alameda County and Los Angeles County, something many listeners don't know, were essentially under these provisions of the Voting Rights Act in the 90s. So it wasn't purely based on 60s and 70s turnout. It had a little flexibility. That's something actually the majority of the court didn't even mention today, not really in the opinion at all, and that's quite odd.
I want to get back to you with respect to Los Angeles County and its history, especially in the 1990s. But first, let me turn to Kings County, which you mentioned, one of those named under the Voting Rights Act. Ken Baird is the county clerk recorder for Kings County. Mr. Baird, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
What does this mean to you in Kings County? How different will your life be as a result?
Well, actually, I think our life won't be that different. Our county council's life might be significantly different because they were primarily in charge of helping us do our submissions to the Department of Justice. You know, as far as the everyday running of an election, I don't see that we will see many changes with that. But we will, at least in the short term, depending on what Congress does, I think we're probably going to be exempt from making those submissions to the Department of Justice.
The Supreme Court did say that Congress has the opportunity to update the information it uses in order to determine which jurisdictions fall under the Civil Rights Act of 1965. We'll hear later on our To the Point program that a lot of people think it's unlikely at the moment that the Congress, divided as it is going to do that. So you're probably off the hook. When you say submissions to the Department of Justice, what do you mean? What does that involve?
Well, it can be just about anything that is a change in the way you conduct your elections. So, if you had to change a polling place or a jurisdiction changed their boundaries, all of those were subject to review by the Department of Justice.
Okay, so how did Kings County turnout get so low all those years ago, below 50% for a presidential election?
Well, actually, if you look at all the counties in California that are subject to Section 5, they all in the 60s and 70s had large military installations and relatively small populations by comparison. So the population, your population counted all of the people who were part of that military installation, but a vast majority of those people don't vote in your jurisdiction. They usually vote absentee in their home jurisdictions. Or, in fact, they may, be deployed someplace outside the county at the time of the election. And so that has a way of watering down your turnouts. Kings County historically has relatively low turnouts, and we think it's primarily because of the military base here.
Okay. Ken Barrett again, County Clerk Recorder for Kings County. Justin Levitt, back to you at Loyola Law School. Los Angeles doesn't have a military installation in it. How did Los Angeles fall under the Voting Rights Act of 1965 back in the 1990s?
And it's one of these breathing in and breathing out provisions. So Congress said if a federal court finds intentional discrimination, the effort to restrict minority rights, not necessarily because of hatred or because of what the court calls animus, but acts taken that treat in Los Angeles Latinos differently from others intentionally and worse, then the federal court can require something very similar to the sort of preclearance that Mr. Baird was talking about. It can ask for the county to run all new submissions by the court instead of by the Department of Justice. In the 90s, Los Angeles County embarked on a series of redistricting proposals for its county commission, and like most of the decades before, ran into trouble where the county commissioners had drawn lines, and this was found by a court, that intentionally broke up the growing and vibrant Latino community. And that was enough of a problem for the court that the court essentially said, okay, from here on out, any changes that you've got, run by us first.
By commissioners, do you mean Board of Supervisors?
Yes, by the county board, that's right.
Yeah, so they're called supervisors in L.A. County. So there are only five of them, and yet they were breaking up a congregation, you're saying, of Latino voters. Was that designed then, as far as the federal government was concerned, to provide for a Latino seat?
It was designed to at least give Latinos the opportunity to elect a candidate of choice, which is really the legal standard. And all this was done not necessarily because people hated Latinos, but because there was a threat in the Latino community to the existing power structure. The Latino community preferred different types of candidates than the remainder of the LA community. And so the supervisors drew their lines accordingly. The repair was to ensure that the lines were drawn at least in order to give Latino voters the opportunity to elect the candidate of choice. I should mention that LA is also significant in one other regard. It's really an odd local jurisdiction. As I know you've pointed out before, often, Warren, LA County has something on the order of 10 million residents, and that's particularly with five supervisors. That's an awful lot of representation. One supervisor essentially represents a whole lot more citizens than many states have in their U.S. senator and their gubernatorial representatives. And so L.A. is the largest local jurisdiction in the country, and in some ways I think the attention of the court was focused on the fact that if a change like that would really impact so many people and deny so many of the Latino population an opportunity to be heard.
Gloria Molina, of course, was ultimately elected to that newly drawn district. There hasn't been another Latino, however, elected, even though now the county is, I think, getting close to being predominantly Latino. Would Los Angeles County, if the court hadn't made the decision it did, likely to be again subject to the Voting Rights Act? Or what about those who are Asian and the large communities we have of people from other areas who all have suffered racial discrimination from time to time?
That's a great question, Warren. And sure enough, when the federal courts here in Los Angeles dealt with the issue last time, they essentially put LA under a 10-year check-in with us first order. That expired at the end of the last cycle, and this redistricting cycle was the first time in a long time that LA had drawn districts without the government watching over their shoulder. I actually spoke before the supervisors and spoke to the supervisors before they drew their lines, and I am quite concerned that they may have a problem again. As you point out, LA is getting quite close to majority Latino. There are enough Latino citizens of voting age that I think they really have earned a second opportunity district, not a guarantee, but an opportunity to elect candidates of choice in LA.
I'm going to interrupt you simply in the interest of time. And once again, later on our To the Point program, we'll go into the decision itself in great more detail. One of the legacies of the civil rights movement has apparently been substantially altered, at least in its implementation. Thank you both. Justin Levitt with at Loyola Law School and Ken Baird, the county clerk reporter for Kings County. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com/whichwayla or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find Which Way LA on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
We're only back with Which Way LA. KCRW's continuing series, LA Grows Up, has focused on high-rise residential buildings to accommodate increasing urban density. But the process also includes growing small. Paul Habibi teaches real estate at UCLA's Graduate School of Management. The professor is also a developer of apartment buildings. Good to have you on our program.
Pleasure to be here.
Tell us about micro apartments coming to Los Angeles.
Well, micro apartments, while new to Los Angeles, are certainly not new to other metropolitan areas around the world and the United States, in fact. It really plays on this idea of the densification of Los Angeles. We were originally built as a sprawl society post-World War II, but as we've seen through the increase in congestion and the difficulties with creating large-scale transportation networks, that it's become much more easy to try to co-locate jobs and housing and really create these urban communities, which for a long time were kind of foreign to Angelenos, but as of late they've basically become a necessity. So this idea of micro apartments is really a solution to help increase the supply of housing units in dense urban areas, and of course to try to lower the price point, which to many renters is currently unattainable.
What is a micro apartment? How do you define that?
Well, in the typical definition of the term is something that's in the neighborhood of about 300 units. 300 square feet. You know, your typical apartment is, you know, in many cases twice the size for a comparable unit. So it's really creating an efficient, livable space. And so within those 300 square feet, you have kind of a layering of uses, be it your kitchen, your living area, your sleeping area, and of course the washroom. And so by trying to really increase the efficiency level of these units, and in many cases they're intended really for one person or maybe two people, you're expanding the affordability level to the typical tenant who then can now afford to live closer to their place of work, hopefully.
What do you do with your stuff?
Well, in some cases, you know, you leave it with your parents, you store it, but really you learn to make do on just the necessities. You walk through an IKEA store, I think a lot of us have seen kind of what a typical storage compartment would look like in one of these units, where you're basically down to the bare necessities. But of course, it's a lot easier to pay rent on area that you use on a day-to-day basis and really store the rest than it is to basically schlep all your stuff into your unit every time you move.
Are all the cities around the Los Angeles area, Southern California, eager to have micro apartments?
Well, it's one of those things where, like anything else, there's an adoption curve to it. So in a place where, you know, you have a lot of NIMBYism, where the neighbors really don't want people to build in their communities, you know, they view this as something where you're increasing the population density in their community. And, of course, a lot of people see that as increasing congestion. But the reality behind the situation is that by actually increasing the density, what you're doing is you're co-locating jobs and housing, which for a long time has been a little bit of an unattainable goal in L.A. You know, you take a place like downtown L.A., for example, you have about 17 jobs for every housing unit. And so, you know, one of the reasons we have so much congestion in our city, which, by the way, is comprised of 88 different municipalities, is because you have this dislocation of jobs and housing. But by actually mixing the two in communities, you'll be able to solve a lot of that problem.
Okay, Paul Habibi, real estate professor at UCLA's Graduate School of Management, also a developer of apartment buildings. We're going to continue this conversation, and we'll come back to you in a moment. Frances Anderton is here with me in the studio. She's producer and host of KCRW's program DNA, Design and Architecture, and she's here to tell us about a timely exhibition about growing small. Great to have you with us.
Very nice to be with you, Warren, and sure, this topic is absolutely fascinating. And it's one that's being explored in a tiny little storefront gallery on Hollywood Boulevard called WooHo. And what this show is, it's called How Small is Too Small. And basically, the curators of the show, Katrina Stolz-Sabo and Takako Tajima, they have, with a team of supportive people, put together, they have built a micro unit. They have built a unit that is 10 feet by 30 feet. And their idea is basically to explore this trend. They are saying exactly what the professor was just saying, that this is a trend that's proliferating, but it's relatively new to LA. Come into the storefront gallery, get a taste, get a feel for the gallery. In fact, let's hear Katrina telling us why they did feel it was so important to build out this space.
Most people probably have not been inside a 300 square foot unit. And so the reason why we wanted to build one, more importantly than anything else, was to give people a sense of what it's like to be inside of it. You know, we intentionally posed the title of the exhibit as an open-ended question because it certainly is a very personal question. There isn't an answer that can say what is the right size for everyone. So, you know, whereas one person can probably do just fine in a place that's 100 square feet, someone else couldn't.
Well, she's taking micro units even smaller, down to
100 square feet. That's like being in the closet.
Being in the closet or being on a boat. Some people actually like to live in a boat. So some people do like to live very small. But so far in LA, we haven't quite got to that level. But she and her co-curator are arguing that there are an increasing number of groups that are going to be attracted to these units. And like the professor said, they include people who simply want to live near where they work. Then there's also other groups. They include grandparents who might live elsewhere but want to have a little place near their grandchildren. They're even thinking of demographics like emancipated foster children, children who have come out of the system at age 18, can't possibly afford a more expensive place to live, don't have a family to live with. They include students. And then there's another group that they say we should be thinking about, one that most of us hadn't even thought about. Let's hear Katrina again.
But then we've also been looking at other interesting things, for example, like super commuters. Los Angeles now is the second fastest growing city for super commuters, with most coming from San Francisco, San Jose, and San Diego.
So these are people who can absolutely afford rent. These are working people who are having an almost sort of jet set working life, not one necessarily one would want to be having. But anyway, we're looking at these micro units, which used to be associated with affordability, with low income living, and absolutely they still are. There is a group that absolutely needs these units, and they are being built in places like Santa Monica and downtown LA. But no, these are considered a kind of new desirable place to live. And let's hear Katrina again on how desirable these are to a particular community.
There is a fascinating community out there that is really interested in micro units. I mean, especially of a younger generation, there seems to be some sort of a trend that's going on right now. There are blogs, there are movies, there are videos, all sorts of ways that people are out there currently sharing their spaces with the public to come up with these creative ways, because it does require a certain creativity. And that's something that, you know, interested us as well, is how to design this in such a way to make it highly flexible.
These units do raise a number of planning questions, which I think we'll get to in a minute. But probably this what we just heard from Katrina segues very nicely into our next guest who has built a complex that is designed to appeal to exactly this community.
And that is Alan Di Bartolomeo, who is Chief Development Officer for American Multifamily, Inc. That's called AMF. His company's just opened a micro-apartment building in Glendale. It's called Aleve Lofts and Skydeck. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
How big are yours? I understand they're a little bigger than 300 square feet.
They're 375 square feet, and encompassed in that is a kitchen, a full-size bathroom, a living area, and what we'll call a bedroom. I say bedroom because we have sliding glass doors that close it off, as well as a closet. So we've got all the important aspects of a full-size apartment in something that's obviously much smaller.
Well, 375 square feet as opposed to 300, you're talking about a palace.
Could be.
What about parking?
Well, these units, by code here in the city of Glendale, all have one stall per unit as a requirement. We have 250 stalls in the entire building here, and there's a few extras, but for the most part, it's limited to one stall per.
So then if you have two people living there, they could only have one car, they'd have to share it.
Well, that's one thing. And in Glendale, as in many urban areas, much larger, in fact, downtown Los Angeles, there are public parking structures, and one can rent space there if they need to. We neither encourage or discourage. I guess just by the fact that we have one space per unit, we're discouraging. But we're free market, and if people want to have additional cars and they're willing to pay for it and park, they can certainly do so.
Are you crowding the neighborhood if, in fact, you have many small apartments, tiny micro apartments, and each one of them has a parking space?
Well, the parking is subterranean to the building, and it's not visible to the streets. And as in a lot of areas, it's not possible to park. We're in a civic center. We're in the downtown specific plan, and there really isn't, except for paid meter parking, that available on the streets. So we accommodate all that we need to. Yeah, there may be an average. We're seeing right now an average of maybe 1.2, 1.3 people per unit. But for the most part, there's ones in there. And there's a parking structure next door, so we don't see that sort. In fact, the city invited and wanted to have this sort of density in their downtown. They planned for it. When we brought our project to them, they said, this is just what we're looking for, to bring people to the downtown, in the restaurants, in the stores, and get a liveliness that hadn't been here before.
What's the range of rents for apartments that are 375 square feet?
They start at $1,500 and may range up $100 or more so dollars from that for orientation or getting higher in the building. That's the range.
So these are relatively affordable. They're not super cheap, $1,500 for a 375 square feet unit. However, what is important about developments like this and what the curators of the show at WUHO will make clear, will emphasize, is that these kind of micro units have to be located in an urban space. They have to, part and parcel of living in that tiny little space is that you have access to the cafes, to the local park. You don't feel cramped. And in the development in Glendale, not only does it have that piece of the puzzle, but it also has this Skydeck. The project's called Aleve Lofts and Skydeck. And that rent is going towards paying for the roof where you party with the other Gen Yers in the building, and perhaps the retirees who've also chosen to live there. There's barbecues. So this is part of the package. I think that the professor will also argue that these kind of units can't work in the exurbs or the suburbs. You'd only feel isolated and hemmed in.
You got the name right. I called it Aleve Loft. It's Aleve Loft. So we're talking about the sky deck. You can elevate yourself. Paul Habibi, back to you at UCLA Anderson Graduate School of Management. What about it? Are they limited necessarily then to downtown areas, places where there's already density?
Well, yes, and by definition, that's really where these types of units work best. But, you know, it's important to keep in mind that this is filling a very vital market need, and that is, you know, there's currently a big shortage in the housing stock. You know, I did a report for the Mayoral Housing Summit last year, and, you know, one of the things that came out of it was that we need to provide about 22,000 housing units in our LA County relative to the 13,000 we tend to be delivering on an annual basis. And so with this acute shortage of housing that's being delivered and with job growth and the densification of urban areas, you know, really the only way out of it, with the exception of, you know, trying to pump more money into providing subsidies, is really to decrease the size of the average unit so that you're actually able to bring those residents closer to their places of employment. And, you know, while this is a very socially and environmentally responsible thing to do, the reason it works today is because it also pencils. It's got a tremendous economic motive. The developers who are doing it can reap a much higher price per square foot on these smaller units than they would in the larger units. And while it's a little bit more expensive to build because you tend to have more kitchens and bathrooms per building area, your profit motivation is maximized, as is your social and environmental. So this is something that's, I think, here to stay and that really has legs and is really part of the future of our urban area as well as others.
You said there's a real need for affordable housing. $1,500, with all due respect to Mr. DiBartolomeo, is a lot of money, it sounds like to me, for people who are in the jobs that are increasing the most in our community, which are those that are lowest paying. So is there, Paul Habibi, a contradiction there?
Well, I don't think there's a contradiction. If you look at the current numbers, you know, the median rent in LA County tends to be about $1,900, give or take. But the median income earner can afford $1,325. As it stands, about 60% of all median income earners are considered cost burdened. This is actually a HUD study that was performed saying that they're spending more than a third of their income on housing. So to introduce a unit at $1,500 is actually you know, working in the right direction. Granted, it's still above the median income earner, but it's still, you know, well below the median rental value in LA County, which largely consists of older housing stock.
Francis, we have time for one more question.
Well, just that this is the future that we as Angelenos are going to have to be thinking about, that we've so seen this place as a place where you have space and you expand, that the region expands infinitely, and these micro units are making us think differently. I do think that there's a real question about the parking. It's very well to leave your car in the basement, but at some point that car is going to be on the road. And communities do have concerns about the kind of the impact of these developments.
Well, thank you all for being with us. Again, Paul Habibi is a professor at UCLA Anderson Graduate School of Management. Alan DiBartolomeo is with AMF, American Multifamily, in Glendale. We've heard about the Eleve Lofts and Skydex. I'm still stumbling over that one. And Francis Anderton, great to have you in the studio. Thanks for joining us here.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page.